Okay. Any questions before get started? So there's one thing that there's a couple of things. The main topic today is knowledge-based planning. As I said, you should have read the chapter on hierarchical task network planning from the book. But there are a couple of things that I want to tie up from the last class before I get into that. So about 15 minutes or so we'll spend on some more stuff from last class on bounded length planning. One of the questions is that you should be able to answer for yourself is, we said that bounded length planning can be seen as model finding, and that you can set constraints to encode lines of proof. And of those, basically there are, if you just set up constraints to encode lines of proof, you could actually solve those constraints directly to solve the plan, find a plan of length, which is the length of the encoding. But then you can solve these constraints faster if you do some propagation, some constraint propagation. That's just normally true for all CSP problems. Okay, and one of the things we found is, in fact, starting from planning graph and converting that into a SAT encoding winds up actually being faster. So in fact, the best planner based on satisfiability currently winds up starting from planning graph and, you know, after the mutex propagation on the planning graph, converting it into SAT encodings and then building on top of it. So part of the reason there, as I was mentioning last time, is that you could do certain types of constraint propagation which makes sense for planning more easily, because you're doing mutual exclusion, which is actually sort of a partial tree consistency enforcement on the underlying CSP. Okay, you could have done this here too, except generic CSP solvers may not know what is the right type of consistency enforcement that is relevant for planning. Okay, so you may as well actually go this way. Now, having said that, pretty much the only reasonable bounded length planners that seem to work well are those that essentially start from planning graph. Should we even bother about direct proof-based encodings? We learned all of this, but the question is, should we bother about it? Would there ever be use for this? And so basically, clearly graph plan-based encodings are better than backward proof-based encodings, which is the closest to them. And because graph plan does mutex propagation, and mutex propagation is harder to do in direct SAT, because there are just so many other CSP, you know, propagation strategies that are more, you know, obvious there. You could, of course, write a very specific mutex strategy, a propagation strategy for SAT, but you may as well do it at the planning graph level. So the question then is, why do we even care about proof-based encodings if they never win? The idea is that even though the history in classical planning went this way, where planning graph was invented separately, and then more or less parallelly, the proof-based encodings were invented, and then basically people found that actually the encodings that come from planning graph were much faster. Okay, but normally given a newer planning problem, for example, not classical planning, but let's say conformant planning, okay, where conformant planning would be a scenario where you don't have full knowledge about the initial state. You have disjunction in the initial state. So you may know that some conditions are definitely true, but some other conditions, you know, either you know, for example, that the initial state, either P is true or Q is true. You don't know which of them is true, let's say. So the bomb in the toilet problem that many of you probably heard about from the 471 is a classic case of a conformant planning scenario where you have a partially observable initial state. You don't quite know in the bomb in the toilet problem which package contains the bomb. So it's either in the package 1 or package 2. Okay, suppose you're trying to solve such problems. Suppose you want to generate line plans, sequential plans, even when the initial state has disjunction. Okay, one advantage is that if you actually are thinking in terms of proof-based encodings, and if you like looking at something like SAT encoding, you can deal with it by just not doing much at all. You know, all you need to do is you have to say the initial state previously, you know, the initial state facts were all individually asserted to be true. Now you have a real clause saying PRQ is true at the zeroth level. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is that the first ideas, first attempts at looking for plans for more complex planning problems may well be done with proof-based encodings. Because proof-based encoding makes somebody else deal with your problem. All you're saying is, here is when this is a solution. And then you search the space to find me an entity which will be a solution. This is the sort of advantage of prologue style problem. You know, it's doing planning with satisfiability or CSP or IP is sort of like, in the way I'm putting it, is sort of like doing programming with prologue. So you just say what the solution looks like and it will solve it. Now, that prologue programs are rarely, if ever, the fastest programs. Because, you know, you don't provide any search control. And if you don't provide proper search control, you know, the actual runtime might be much worse. Okay. However, it's a good starting point. Okay. So there is actually, somebody said once that neural networks are often the second best way of solving any problem. Okay, and so genetic algorithms would be the third best way of solving any problem if you don't even understand neural networks. And so bounded length planning may well be the second best way of solving many planning problems. Once you understand the problem, you may be able to develop more task-specific strategies for that planning problem. Do you understand? So the mutex propagation in planning graph can be seen as a very specific propagation process that works for deterministic planning, classical planning, essentially. Okay? So it is still worth understanding these things, because in fact you will see that when you get into like the conformant planning or when you get into other types of planning where you start removing the restrictions on classical planning problems, you could wind up, you know, having at least one approach which solves them using satisfiability solvers. I mean, basically SAT solvers or any of these, CSP solvers or IP solvers. So that's one way of thinking about it. Of course, they have their problems, which is at least the normal way I put the bounded length encodings. The one big, big problem with bounded length encoding solvers is the encoding is going to be for a length k. And if you don't have a plan of length k, then you have to do it length k plus 1, length k plus 2. And one of the most interesting directions right now in planning is to find indexless encodings for planning problems. That's basically finding an encoding which doesn't directly depend upon the number of steps in the plan. Okay, and in fact, those are actually quite useful in several ways. They are also useful. So remember that I said in here. In fact, because Will asked me to do this, I did write it, that if you do have an encoding, you can take the relaxation of that encoding, and that could be used for a heuristic. And in fact, as of last year, there are a bunch of people trying to develop indexless encodings for planning, whose relaxations can then be used to provide powerful heuristics. Okay? So, there is still work going on in this direction, and as I said, there are trade-offs, so you can't just give up on any of these techniques yet. Okay, all you are interested in is classical planning, all you need to know is forward search, progression search with reachability heuristics. Pretty much that wins the day right now. Okay, but we now have at least learned about 10 or so methods for doing that problem. But part of the reason is they have trade-offs that wind up being useful when you start considering other problems. other variations of the problem. So in fact, to repeat that point again, many of the techniques that you learn in classical planning may be overkill for classical planning problem, because you already have one good problem, one good solver for it, okay? And yet they could be useful. Generalization of those could wind up being more useful for other kinds of planning problems, such as conformant or temporal planning or stochastic planning and so on. And similarly, classical planning by itself is an abstraction which doesn't actually, is not particularly useful. And yet, you may be able to solve other problems by compiling them down to classical planning instances. Okay, so for those two reasons, the 4 weeks that we spent on this problem are still worth it. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. One thing that I was going to do, very quickly, is Tuan asked, I think, earlier, how is this connected to, graph plan and this whole encodings connected to refinement planning? Because after all, we have talked about refinement planning as a unifying framework. In fact, if you read the paper, I did make those connections earlier, but might as well make them a little bit here. So the idea is that actually it's pretty straightforward as far as the view of refinement planning is concerned. Basically, much of what you're doing, so you can think of all of these as essentially disjunctive planners, the graph plan and SAT plan and all these things as disjunctive planners, in the sense that rather than throw the disjunction in the constraints into the search space, which is what you did in state space planning, in plan space planning, etc. Okay, whenever there is ever any disjunction, if there's promotion versus demotion, you make promotion in one branch, demotion in another branch. You just abhor disjunction. Okay, but you can handle disjunctive constraints directly. Okay, now if you handle disjunctive constraints directly, what happens is, if you remember from the refinement planning terminology, the solution construction, which is enumerating all the minimal candidates of the current partial plan and checking if any one of them is a solution, that can be quite costly. And so in fact, much of what you're doing in SAT plan and graph plan is, you can think of it as, you generated a K-length plan structure, and then you are, the whole of the search, the SAT search or the graph plan search, essentially is enumerating the minimal candidates and checking if any one of them is a solution. That's it. So it's just a solution construction process. Okay? And then, so then what is the refinement? The refinement is, when you don't find a minimal candidate of length K, you extend it further. And that's the refinement. Okay? So basically, if you started from the normal planning, which you could call it conjunctive planning, because we're calling this disjunctive planning, the point about conjunctive planning is that you're essentially keeping all constraints to be conjunctive. Okay? And disjunctive planning, you can have basically disjunctive constraints thrown in. And so here, rather than consider these three as three different plans being pursued in three different search branches, three different partial plans being pursued in three different search branches, you could just say, well, zero followed by a disjunctive action, which is either this or this or this, followed by the end of the plan. Okay, now this ordering, of course, is a contiguity ordering. Remember from the refinement planning stuff, you could have contiguity versus, precedence constraint. This is a contiguity ordering. There can't be any more steps between the beginning and this step, except this step can be any one of these. Okay? And so that's basically, you're handling these kinds of plans directly. And you can also have disjunctive, so graph plan can be thought of as a disjunctive version of a progression planner. Okay, and so you could also have a disjunctive version of a partial order planner or a plan space planner, which would look something like this. So you have a step one whose identity can be either load A or load B, and there is this causal link which is essentially saying that I would either support in A or in B to here, one of them, not both. I mean, one of them, so it's a normal disjunction, so at least one of them I'll be supporting. Okay, and then here also there is disjunctive open conditions. So every constraint that you know, you can have disjunctions of those constraints, and you can work on them. Okay, the reason this is useful, this view is useful, is you can think of at least there is a disjunctive state space planner, which is basically graph plan. Okay, and did you see a disjunctive plan space planner? In fact, disjunctive state space planner, graph plan, as well as what we called last time proof-based encoding with forward progression proof, that's also a disjunctive progression planner. Okay, and so similarly, the plan space disjunctive planner, the closest you have is plan space encodings, the causal encodings that I talked about at the end of last class, where you could have causal links or white-knight criteria thrown in. Okay, now the question, of course, is from the point of view of refinement planning, is there a difference at all between what graph plan does and what a proof-based encoding, like, you know, progression proof-based encoding does? Okay, and you can make an argument about this. Unfortunately, you can't see this completely. I know that these are pretty hard to read. So the idea is, think of the properties of the refinement that we talked about in the past. Okay, what are the good properties of refinement? One, the refinement should be complete. Okay, two, it should be progressive. Okay, and what was the important thing, of course, is the progressiveness. Now, three, systematicity. Now, if you don't split the disjunction into the search space, you don't need to talk about systematicity of the refinement at all, because you always have one single branch, essentially. The search tree has a single branch. Okay, and all the work that you're doing essentially is in compute, you know, in enumerating the minimal candidates and finding one which will be a solution. That's what you're doing. So the question then is when I say convert this to a disjunctive plan like this. So I started with a disjunctive plan and I added a disjunctive step next to it. Okay. So this is refined to this. This is sort of how planning graph works, for example. This is what SAT plan would do if it went from one encoding size to another encoding size. Okay. So the question is whether or not this refinement is progressive, if you're talking about whether or not this refinement is progressive, the question is, are there candidates of this plan that are no longer candidates of this plan? Do you understand what I'm saying? That's all you care about in progression, progressiveness of a refinement. Okay, now, if you do it this way, yes, there could have been, what this plan basically says is, after this, you could have any steps at the next level in the plan, you know, not just these, but any steps from the domain. But this guy is saying only one of these can be the second step. So you're cutting down some of the candidates. Okay, now if you think of what SAT plan does, for example, what SAT plan does, for example, in a way is you essentially, if what you could do is you basically put all the steps at all the levels. Every time you extend the number of levels, you put all possible actions, all possible ground actions at all possible levels. That's what SAT plan does, right? That essentially means it's not progressive at all. So every candidate of the previous plan is also going to be the candidate of the next plan. It's still complete, but it's not progressive. Okay, so from the point of view of refinement planning, the difference between what graph plan does, I mean, and what SAT plan does can be understood in terms of one is a progressive refinement, one is not progressive. And also you can talk about degrees of progressiveness in as much as how many candidates are being eliminated when you refine a plan. And in fact, so the simplest is to put every action in the next level, which is what SAT plan does. Okay? A better idea is to at least not put actions which won't be applicable in the potential union state that comes after this state. because that is not possible anyway, right? If you do that, you cut down some of the candidates. Okay, and a third idea is to not only do that, but also consider which sets of steps cannot be feasible together, which is more like mutual exclusion. So the point I'm trying to make is all the work that GraphPlan does on top of SASPlan, which is essentially computing mutual exclusions and also computing binary mutual exclusions and unary mutual exclusions. Unary means certain actions won't be present at a level. Certain propositions won't be present at a level. All of that can be understood in terms of improving progressiveness. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. That
also can be considered as a refinement.
Basically, it is two directions.
Yeah, but I mean, now we are only the way the planning graph works is essentially it's being construction always in the forward direction. So the important thing to understand, by the way, this is actually a cute point, which is both planning graph and SAT plan can be seen as just the disjunctive versions of progression refinement. That should confuse you a little bit if you are carefully paying attention, because I did say that GraphPlan solution extraction, I mean the way solution extraction is done using GraphPlan ideas corresponds more closely to backward proof strategy, not forward proof strategy. But it turns out that the direction of refinement and the direction of proof are independent. They don't have to be dependent. So you could, for example, think about it this way. You could be doing plan space planning, and when you have a partial plan in front of you, check to see whether or not it is correct by considering all its topological sorts and doing progression on each of them. And if any one of them works, then it's a solution. The reason you wind up using the same proof strategy as the refinement strategy, that is plan space proof strategy with plan space refinement, turns out to be more subtle. It turns out that those proof strategies can be incrementally extended from one iteration to another iteration. In fact, in the plan space planning, for example, you keep track of how many open conditions have already been satisfied. And when you extend it further, then there are more new open conditions come, but some have gone away because you started supporting them. So you don't have to restart proof from scratch, where proof basically being looking at all possible minimal candidates and checking if any one of them is a solution. If you use the proof strategy that corresponds to the refinement, then you could have these advantages. But there is no reason you must use it. So GraphPlan and SASPlan still should be seen as progression-based disjunctive planners who just happen to use differing solution construction methods, solution extraction methods. Okay? And the only reason this could be useful is if you want to keep track of why is refinement planning still relevant and whether or not it adds you, it gives you any insights as to how this plan works. Okay? Okay. Are there any questions on this stuff? Otherwise, I am done with basically this whole business of bounded length planning. Bounded length planning connected to graph plan, bounded length planning connected to proof strategies, bounded length planning connected to disjunctive refinement planning. All of that we're done. Okay. So the next thing that I want to do is basically what has been called knowledge-based planning. And in particular, the main technique that we'll talk about today is this thing called hierarchical planning. But then we'll talk about other knowledge-based planning techniques next class. But before we get in there, let me remind you that we have been doing what we have called domain-independent planning until now. The idea was that you provide, So this is the picture to keep in mind. So you are essentially trying to generate, given each domain, you could write a C program that generates plans in that domain. If your life depended on this, this is what you would do. Ranko block soil planner, Ranko logistics planner, and then Ranko job shop planner. Okay, so so the input for these planners is at best just the initial state and the goal state. Domain is already inbuilt for the planner. Do you understand? A domain independent planner, on the other hand, takes as its input initial state, goal state, and the action description, which is the domain dynamics. It's the first time it sees it. Okay? And then, so whatever is inside the planner, it's not been customized to a specific domain. Everything we did, the heuristics we did, they were not customized to a specific domain. They are customized to basically, the only assumption they have is that the domains are written in this precondition effect formalism. That's it. And you can write very different kinds of domains, easier versus harder domains in that formalism. Okay. So that this is sort of taking a general purpose domain independent planning. That's what we've been doing. Okay. And the underlying assumption, of course, is, you know, who would want to write planners for each domain separately? But we do understand that if your boss wants you to write a planner for a particular domain, and all that matters is how fast that planner is in producing the longest plans, the largest plan, and your job depends on that, you're going to just not going to necessarily start from here. You just write a C program or whatever favorite language program just for solving that domain. Okay. So in fact, there are people who have, because BlocksWorld has, for whatever reason, has been called the fruit fly of automated planning, in the sense, you know, everybody tries to check their planner first on the BlocksWorld domains. There have been people who actually consider just writing a very domain-specific BlocksWorld planner, which can basically take any arbitrary configuration and take it to any other arbitrary configuration, you know, with as short a plan as possible. It turns out, by the way, that since as long as we're talking about BlocksWorld, optimal planning in BlocksWorld, that is finding the shortest number of actions to go from the initial state to the goal state, that's NP-hard. But finding a plan in BlocksWorld is polynomial. Because you can always start from whatever initial state you are in, put all the blocks on the table and construct them bottom up for every stack in the goal state. The problem that way is that the plan that you would get that way is within twice the length of the optimal plan. Within twice the length of the optimal plan. So at least for BlocksWorld, if you're only looking for any plan, it's really not a hard problem at all. But there could be, within the same formalism of preconditions and effects, you could have domains which are actually finding a feasible plan is hard. That's the interesting point of this kind of representation. Now, having said all this, suppose I have situations where not only is the domain dynamics available, which is, by domain dynamics, I normally mean actions and their preconditions and effects. What are the actions possible? When can they be done? And how will they change the world? That's the pure domain dynamics. Okay, that's all we've been putting in the PDL file till now. But suppose people say, look, I have more stuff about this domain. I want to give it to you. Okay, could you not take that information and somehow use it? Okay, so what we'll be talking about when we talk about knowledge-based planning is essentially this view of, it's sort of in between those two extremes, where you are getting extra information about the domain in some particular format, and if that information is available, you wind up using it to, in essence, improve your performance. If it's not available, to heck with it. Okay, so the idea then is, if you do have this domain specific knowledge for a particular domain, you can use that to customize your performance to that domain. So that's the idea. Okay, now the question, of course, then is, what is the format in which this knowledge is available and how to use it? This is where all sorts of interesting crazy things happen. The problem is that it might be easier to write a planner. So if you have a planner, which already is, you know, let's say a progression planner or a plan space planner or something. Okay, it's not necessary that any kind of domain knowledge that I give can be easily directly used in the underlying planner. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because certain types of knowledge is much easier to use. So for example, if I said, by the way, never, you know, support a condition for the goal using this kind of an action, that is the kind of knowledge that I can use best in plan space planning because it uses causal links. Okay. If on the other hand I said, by the way, never go through the following two states in succession because it's bad news, how does a plan space planner use that? I mean, can potentially use it, but see, the point of course is the hard one thing that you can always do if you have domain specific knowledge, you could do it this way. You could let the domain independent planner run, generate a solution, and use this knowledge and see if the solution is consistent with the knowledge that's given. If it is, you say, I used it. Okay. So the problem, of course, is you are using domain-specific knowledge then as a filtering procedure. And if you really want to exploit it to improve the performance of planning, you need to use it in generation. And this is what you want to keep in mind in terms of, you know, how is the knowledge available and how it's going to be used. So in the best of all cases, what I would like to do is I can pick any planner, I can pick any kind of domain knowledge, and it should be able to use that domain knowledge in the planner. That's not likely to happen. So instead, what you would wind up seeing is a couple of, at least two things we'll look at, for example, hierarchical planners, which are in essence best seen, the more normal hierarchical planners, hierarchical task network planners, are best seen as partial order planners or plan space planners using non-primitive tasks, non-primitive actions. And we'll talk about what it means. But you heard about it before. I could have, for example, in a plan space plan, 0 followed by an action A followed by infinity, where this action A, by the way, is really A1 or A2. So that's sort of least commitment. I haven't yet decided which specific action it is, but it's one of them. Okay, that idea thrown to its logical conclusion, we'll see in a minute, is hierarchical planning. And it's actually most easy to connect it to plan space planning. On the other hand, next week we will look at another idea called, a particular type of knowledge called HTN networks, hierarchical task networks. If it is available, it's best to use them using a plan space planner. Another type of knowledge could be, I know complex formulas about the sequences of states that are worth going through and that are not worth going through. Okay? And if I know that, then who do you think would be most suited to use that kind of knowledge? A progression planner. So we will look at another knowledge-based planning thing called TL plan, which essentially allows complex formulas on state sequences using temporal logic. Because essentially, since you're talking about sequences of states, and you have formulas that should hold over sequences of states, not a single state, okay, you need temporal logic to talk about it. Okay, and then those formulas, it will then essentially check to see that when it has a sequence that it's about to expand to, you know, forward, it checks to make sure that this sequence hasn't already violated one of these rules. If so, if it has violated, you should not expand this. Okay, and of course the question is, which is a better approach? Is TL plan a better approach or HTN planning a better approach? Well, it depends on what kind of knowledge you have about the domain. And the problem is, the moment you start talking about domain-specific knowledge, you are talking now not just about the guy who writes the planner, that's you, but the guy who provides the domain knowledge, who is the domain expert. We never talked about them before because we didn't need them. We just got everything into PDDL and we to heck with the domain experts. But now if you're talking about this kind of domain specific knowledge, where did the domain experts, where did they come from? There are two ways. One, there is a domain expert who provided these. Now when the domain expert is providing these, you don't get to tell them, hey, you know, I like this kind of knowledge, just give me this kind of knowledge. They'll give whatever they would like to give. Whatever is the most naturally available control knowledge for that domain is what they're going to give you. And it's up to you to find a way of using it. I mean, when people give you advice, you don't say, don't give me advice at 3 o'clock, you know, give the advice at 6 o'clock and, you know, 8:30, you know, when I am ready to listen to it. You take it. Whenever the advice is given, you take it, if it's important for you. Okay? The other idea is to just learn this control knowledge yourself. Okay? If you learn, now you can do learn any which kind of knowledge. So the question, of course, then will be what kinds of knowledge is harder to learn and what would be easier to learn from experience. So these hierarchical task networks potentially could be given by domain expert or could be learned. And these complex temporal formulas and sequences of states could be given by domain expert or could be learned. If you're learning, you can learn whichever you want. If you're smart enough to do the learning. If you are taking it from the expert, don't yell at the expert saying, give me the kind of knowledge I want. Now, before I even go into further detail, suppose I want to compare which knowledge-based planning approach is better. How would I go about doing that? Previous to this, suppose I wanted to compare whether progression planning is better or plan space planning is better. It was very clear how to do. Right? It was very clear what to do because take the same domain dynamics, same input, PDDL files, for these two planners and see which one does faster. Okay? But if I'm trying to compare HTN planning to TL planning, TL planner, HTN planner, an HTN planner to a TL planner, now you have an extra variable, which is what kind of knowledge is being used. What kind of knowledge is being used? Okay. Now the problem is the way it's being done currently. The easy way to do these comparisons is to say, suppose you are into HTN planning, so you would say, tell me about your domain. I will write the whole thing into HTN schemas and I'll use it under my HTN planner. And then that guy who is into TL, you know, temporal logic formulas, listens to the same domain, right? And then he thinks more in state sequences, so he writes the information, the control information in the state formula, and then uses his planner. The problem there is now you have the guy who came up with the planner is also acting as the expert. Okay, so it doesn't tell you whether or not that kind of knowledge is actually easily available. Okay, so this is a problem, and in fact, we will come to this a little later, but for a while in the international planning competition, there used to be this track called knowledge-based planning track. The problem with the knowledge-based planning track is we don't know what to compare. The right way to compare it would be that the same English description of the domain is provided, English or Chinese or whichever you like, is provided to not the guys who wrote the planner, but three random people from street, or 15 random people from the street. And then they randomly decide which planner, in fact, either they decide which planner they want to use, so depending on which planner they want to use, they want to convert this English description into control knowledge in either hierarchical task network format or the state sequence format. And then the engine is available, so they can throw it into the planning engine and then they can run it. This is hard. User studies are hard. Getting people to take, you know, this stuff and converting it to, you know, search control knowledge is hard. So what happened in the competition normally is the guys who wrote, this is one guy called Fahim Bakas who came up with the TL plan framework. So he would be with his planner standing next to it. And so you give both of them the domain model, I mean the English domain description. And so he will think for a bunch of time and come up with the right kind of state sequences, you know, temporal logic formulas and state sequences. And then he'll use it on his planner. And then there's a guy, although there are a lot more HTN planners, there's one particular version of hierarchical task network planner we'll look at in a minute, sometime today, called SHOP, which was developed by a guy called Dana Now, and he would stand with his planner, and he would take the English description, convert it into what are called SHOP schemas, which are basically hierarchical task networks for SHOP, and he'll solve it. The problem now is you don't quite know what are you comparing. Are you comparing Dana versus Fahim, or are you comparing the two planners? And is there a way of separating them from their planners? And not surprisingly, no longer do we have a knowledge-based planning competition. Okay, in the knowledge-based planning competition in the IPC. It's not because knowledge-based planning is a bad idea, but because evaluation is actually harder. Many things that are important in life are hard to evaluate. Okay, for example, user interfaces, the classic case. So if you came up with a user interface, you love it. I was just telling my students that my handwriting is extremely beautiful. Look at that. I looked at it and when I printed it, it looks so cute. Okay, and that's basically what we do when we try to do interface design. We look at our own interfaces, yeah, it looks pretty darn good. And you try to publish this stuff in CHI, which is human interaction conference. In the first several years, pretty much, that's how it used to be published. And then the psychologists who come to that conference started saying, are you guys gone crazy? I mean, have you ever heard of outsiders actually evaluating it? And it's very hard to get outsiders to evaluate your interfaces. And furthermore, you can't be done with your interface design the day before the conference deadline and then try to evaluate it because there are no users to be found. Okay, so sometimes evaluation is as hard as coming up with the idea, much harder than coming up with the idea. And knowledge-based planning is sort of like that. We haven't yet figured out which type of knowledge-based planning is better because we have never done a third-party analysis of what do, you know, average Joes from the street like. Do they like state sequences better? Do they like hierarchical schemas better? What is the language in which they want to write what they know about the domain? It has not been done. Okay. Having said all that, that's in the back of the head, and then we will talk first about this hierarchical task network planning, and next class, you know, we'll talk about the TL plan version. Okay. So what is hierarchical task network planning? As I said, basically, you now allow not just the normal actions, which are basically the actions that are executable in the domain. You also allow what are called non-primitive tasks, non-primitive actions. These non-primitive actions, here, this non-primitive action was a placeholder for a disjunction over A1 or A2. It's really either A1 or A2. Rather than do A1 separately, A2 separately, I put one plan with just A, and that corresponds to a disjunctive constraint. Okay. Normal hierarchical planning does it much more, has more flexibility in defining the non-primitive task. It, for example, looks sort of like this. So, for example, here's the travel domain, traveling from some source to some destination. Now, in a travel domain, the kind of primitive tasks that you might have are, you know, getting into a bus, getting into a train, buying a ticket, getting out of the bus, getting out of the train, and also hitchhiking. Those are all the primitive actions, okay? And all of these can actually take a point and another point and then go from one point to another point. Especially for hitchhiking, you can say hitchhike X to Y. And then if you're lucky, you can get, you know, a ride from X to Y. Now the interesting thing, of course, is if you're trying to look for travel plans and if all you have are primitive actions, you would consider any plan that is correct. That means if you start executing it from the initial state, it will get to the goal state. That's it. Okay, but obviously not all plans are created equal. Okay, for example, a travel plan for going from Phoenix to San Francisco, which involves A little bit of hitchhiking, followed by a little bit of driving yourself, followed by a little bit of, flight, followed by another little bit of hitchhiking, followed by another little bit of whatever. You see what I'm saying? So a thousand of these actions, which does take you from one end to the other end, it's a solution, but it may not be a useful solution. So normally, you might want to think in terms of, well, if you want to travel from source to destination, you have really two options, going by bus or going by train. If you want to go by bus, you really have to convert this into a plan fragment, which involves getting into the bus, buying the ticket inside the bus, and getting out of the bus. And if you want to go into the train, then you have to buy the ticket before. Normally trains, may require, like in this domain I decided that the trains require the tickets before you get on. And then you get into the train and you get out of the train. Now notice that the hitchhiking part, I didn't touch it. Okay, so as far as I am concerned, if I want to travel from a source to destination, I'll either try this or try this. And any plan which I can get through either this way or this way is a plan that I would produce. Okay, so now what am I giving extra? I'm actually giving extra the sort of reduction schema. These are called, so here is a non-primitive task. Here is two different ways of reducing it. You can either reduce it to going by bus or going by train. And the going by bus can be reduced in this case just one way, which is to get into the bus. And it's actually a partial plan, even though it's not clear in this picture. It's getting into the bus, followed by buying a ticket, followed by getting out of the bus. Now, the interesting point, of course, is, so here is actually, so go by bus corresponds to that plan right there. That's what I have in mind. Okay, now notice that getting into the bus precedes buying a ticket, which precedes getting out of the bus. Okay, furthermore, I also am providing extra information. I am saying to be able to do this, so for example, for going by bus, I know that this abstract task itself, it has some preconditions and effects. It requires that it must have money, that you must have money before taking the action, and then when the action is over, you will be at the destination. So there is a precondition and an effect for the, at the high level. Now what happens when you reduce it is the precondition that it is taking will actually be eaten by somebody in the reduction. So the have money precondition of this guy is actually being used by the buy ticket operation in this case. Okay? And similarly, the effects that this guy said he will give, or he or she will be given in this case by some, has to be given by at least some guy in the reduction. So in this case, it's being given by T3. Okay? Now the point, of course, is I've decided to have precedence relations on this schema. What are the other kinds of relations I could have had? It's a plan fragment. Going by bus involves this. It's a plan fragment. Right? Here the plan fragment is decided in terms of what it takes, what it gives out, and what is the ordering of the actions inside. The orderings here are precedence relations. You could also have done what else instead of precedence relations?
Between non-primitive.
What?
Between non-primitive.
Yeah, contiguity relations. Contiguity relation says to go by bus, you must get into the bus right after that. Even before you take a breath, you must buy a ticket. Okay? And right after that, before you take a breath, you get out. Do you understand what I'm saying? If I were to put, instead of precedence relations, if I were to put contiguity relation, what did I do? I reduced the usefulness of the schema. Okay? I mean, this plan fragment is useless if it must be done one after other. There's nothing else can interleave. Normally, when we have plans, we tend to interleave them. I have a general idea of how to go home. I also have a general idea of how to, do other things. And then these plans get interleaved. And the only way you can allow interleaving is to allow precedence relations. Okay, nothing stopped me from saying the schema should be written such that they must have contiguity relation. The only thing that would be affected is the flexibility of the schema itself. It's not as good a domain knowledge. And especially in a domain where people, where the expert thinks this more or less works with a few exceptions. And the exceptions you are supposed to figure out when you are not allowed to interleave. Okay. In particular, you seem to have enough information that suppose between this and this, if some action comes which violates having ticket. Okay, so for example, you know, you have an action called burn all the paper with you. Okay, which if you put it right in between these two actions, it will also burn ticket, assuming the ticket is made of paper. And that is not a good thing to interleave. As you may have found when you, you know, you get into, I mean, at least in the Washington DC metro, you need to show the subway ticket both when you get in and when you get out. Many a time, you know, you throw, you know, you're sitting in the metro, you have nothing to do, you want to clean up your pockets. You throw a bunch of this stuff, and including sometimes the ticket, and then you're stuck, you can't get out. You interleave, and you do have to do other things. I mean, imagine if you are not allowing interleaving, then as you're going through the metro, you can't do anything. You just are waiting to get off. And you can't think, you can't check your email, you can't do anything. Okay? In general, plans are made such that we interleave them. This is the way we do planning in our own lives. Okay? So, my argument is that plan fragments should be described with precedence relations. Why am I making a huge big deal? Because you will see that the one HTN planner that works now defines them with contiguity relations. Why? You'll see in a minute that if you have this flexibility in the way the domain knowledge is given, then the details of the planning become hairy. Details of the planning become hairy. Just a second. Okay? So then what do? You say, give me stuff that will make my life easy as the planning guy. That is a no-no. Computer science people are not supposed to complain to users. Users are always right. I mean, they say customers are always right, and so domain experts are always right. You don't get to tell them, don't tell me the knowledge that will make it hard for me. This is sort of more or less what students say. You know, don't tell me too much. You know, it makes my life hard. But you don't get to say that. You take the knowledge that's easily available and find a way to use it. But because you don't differentiate between the guy who wrote the planner and the guy who is writing the domain knowledge, it comes in a package. You know, the guy can say, well, Dana is looking at the English description of the domain and he's going to convert it into knowledge and use it. So yeah, he'll do it whichever way he wants. He can do it with contiguity relation. Now, never mind that anybody else looking at that domain and writing the domain knowledge may have written it more like this. Okay? So that's something that will happen. Yes, sir. Yes, 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 but that's always the case. But as the computer science guy, you don't get to tell the... So, for example, it's easier if the world has deterministic dynamics. Right? It's easier if the world has only instantaneous actions. Then planning becomes somewhat easy, only piece-based complete. But we get to stop now and say planning community can stop now. Because, you know, we would hope tomorrow onwards the world becomes deterministic so that our approaches can be used. You don't get to do that. You don't get to change the world. You have to deal with the world that is there. Okay? So why is it that you get to... So again, if on one hand the HTN schemas are being learned automatically, then I don't care because the whole thing comes in a package. Right now the problem is the package has to increase gen enough. Okay, so I had this slide once, I mean, I might show you later on, that the way to download SHARP is to download SHARP as well as Dana. And the way to download TLPlan is to download TLPlan and Fahim. In fact, I'll show you some temporal logic formulas that Fahim wrote for Bloxworld, which I don't think I would have written. and have thought of Bloxford, you know. It's not obvious at all. It's great stuff that he could write it. Right? But on the other hand, you know, the question is, could I have written it? If I couldn't have written it, I can't use that as input to his planner. And because he wrote it, he could then show that TL plan really solves Bloxford problems fast. Okay? So the issue is, if you're expecting domain knowledge that you're not learning yourself, then there is just, you know, you don't tell the guys who are giving you the knowledge, do it on my terms. You don't get to tell them, do it on your terms. You beg that, just give me something, I'll find a way of using it. Okay? So what are the minimal requirements for a reduction schema? What are the minimal requirements for a reduction schema? If I were to say, here is a reduction schema for this particular action, what should it ensure? For every effect of the task T, there is some task T dash in that reduction schema which gives that effect. Okay? And for every causal link and precedence constraint that T takes part in, okay, actually, let me, to understand this, before you understand this, let's go into, let's go into this. So what happens when you're doing, when you're actually doing HTML planning, is you may have a plan like this, a current partial plan like this, which says, get money, go by bus, buy Wisconsin cheese. The reason I wrote this is because this paper, I presented it in Wisconsin-Madison in 1998, and so the cheese. So that's the best we could do. So anyway, so presumably you're going to Madison to buy cheese, right? And the non-primitive task is to go by bus from Phoenix to Madison. Okay, now this plan is not executable because this essentially is a non-primitive task. And I have my, in my library, remember I have a way of taking go by bus tasks and splitting them into primitive tasks. That's basically this. Get into the bus, buy the ticket, get out of the bus. And it comes with API basically, you know, I must be plugged into the plan in the following way. This is sort of argon replacement. Okay, so this is like a task and then really you need to put, take this out, put this guy in place such that nothing else gets violated. Okay, so what do you need to do essentially? This task which was coming before this now must come before T1 because T1 is the earliest point in the plan fragment. And this task that was coming after this guy must come after the T3. Okay, and then you also must say this guy requires have money and my schema must have told me, yeah, you, this top guy was asking for money. Which of you want the money? So schema must have told me in this particular case, have money gets taken by T2. Okay, so I'll just then screw it up, you know, from here to there. And similarly, this guy requires to give at Madison to somebody. That's the condition that they are going to give. Okay, so who's basically, this schema tells you who gives the at destination effect. So you show it up there. This is what you do when you replace a non-primitive task with its reduction. The normal thing in HTN schemas is these themselves can further be non-primitive tasks. Okay? So the two interesting things, of course, is first of all, for, you know, normally you may not even have, so for example, even going by bus might have two different ways of going by bus. You know, of course, nowadays there are becoming fewer bus alternatives, but in the old days there used to be Trailways and Greyhound. So go by Greyhound, go by Trailways, and it could be possible that, you know, Greyhound has a different protocol as to how to get onto the bus from the Trailways. So there is a choice as to how to expand a non-primitive task. And if you, when you have a choice, essentially you have to consider both of them in the search space. If one fails, you have to consider the other one. Furthermore, even after you expand one non-primitive task to by, you know, putting its plan fragment in place, they themselves can have non-primitive tasks. So in HTN planning, you write for each task whether it's primitive or non-primitive, and if it's non-primitive, there must be a reduction method, at least one reduction method. Okay? And the reduction methods, if there are multiple, then you have to consider all of them, the different ways of doing this top-level task. Okay? So you could see how this could get hairy. I mean, on one hand, I'm making it sound as if this is supposed to make your life easy, but it could make your life hard, because now not only did you have to do all the causal links, unsafe links, open conditions, etc., etc., but now you also have to consider multiple ways of reducing tasks. Okay, obviously this view is close to plan space planning, right? Because if you have precedence constraints, the only planner which uses precedence constraints is plan space planning. Right? And again, remember my argument. You need precedence constraints not because you are stuck with plan space planner and somehow you want to use it, but because precedence constraints are more flexible ways of expressing domain knowledge. Okay? If you have contiguity based domain knowledge, you'll be happier. Okay? So, now having seen this, now you know, you can go back here and say a reduction schema R is valid for reducing a task as long as for every effect of the task T, there is some task T dash which gives the effect. And for every causal link R precedence constraint that this higher level task takes part in, there is some task T dash of the reduction schema that constraint must be redirected to. So this is sort of like API, you know, who goes where from outside into this fragment. Okay? And now, this actually is a slide which by now you should be clear on, but it's worth going through anyway. One of which is if you have this kind of schema, right? I mean, if I showed you, let's say that the schema that I showed you looks like this. This is a very small schema. You could have longer schemas. What if the domain expert gave you a schema which didn't realize, for example, that this should actually precede getting out? In which case, they would have given a schema which corresponds to get into the bus and parallelly buy the ticket and get out in unordered fashion. If you give a bad schema to the planner, and planner then reduces it such that there are no extra violations of causal links or anything, and the plan fails, who is to be blamed? The planner or the guy who gave the domain knowledge? The guy who gave the domain knowledge. Because how would I know that I'm supposed to have done this in parallel? I mean, this is whatever you said is the recipe for getting onto the bus, I'm just following it. Now, of course, one interesting point in what I just said is actually it turns out that if you know all the preconditions and effects of all the tasks, there is a way in which the planner itself, I mean, some automated program can itself check whether or not the schema is valid. It may be hard, but it can do it, which is it should consider all possible interactions that can happen and see if there is one valid reduction which would lead to an unsound plan, then it's not a good schema. Okay? But in general, you would hope that the planner's soundness should depend upon whether or not it gave a sequence of steps that A, can be executed from the initial state to go to the goal state, and B, it somehow uses, it is somehow consistent with the domain knowledge, the extra domain knowledge that was given. Now here is an interesting point. If I give extra domain knowledge about the domain, is that prescriptive or is it suggestive? Okay, so in the travel domain that I have, am I going to allow my planner to come up with a plan that involves hitchhiking? It's a plan, but it just does not correspond to any way of starting from a non-primitive task and reducing it. Right? So one question of course is the domain knowledge prescriptive or suggestive? And we will assume, I mean assuming that domain knowledge is actually, if it is suggestive, then all that matters is you can ignore it, you know, and you can basically, one way of doing HDN planning is to take all the schemas, throw them out the window, do FF or graph plan, because you don't have to follow the suggestions that were given. Okay, they're supposed to help you to do the planning pass, but if it is too much of a pain to rewrite the planner, ignore the knowledge. The interesting part, of course, is oftentimes these schemas are actually prescriptive. You are supposed to do the plans this way. When you do that, in fact, essentially what you're saying is not only does the sequence solve the problem, but it is also a sequence of actions that you could have reached by, essentially, this sequence can be parsed by the task reduction schema, such that there is some non-primitive task, top-level non-primitive task, that if after a whole bunch of reductions will lead to this sequence. When is the last time we heard about parsing? Grammar. Is grammar prescriptive or suggestive? You know, many of us think it's just suggestive. That's why, you know, we use bad English or bad Telugu or whatever. But it's supposed to be prescriptive. And if it's prescriptive, then it's not enough that I got my meaning across. You know, I mean, even if I got my meaning across, it's still not enough unless it's grammatically correct. And grammatically correct means there is a way of parsing the sentence using the grammar rules. Do you understand what I'm saying? So HDN schemas now look like it's like an albatross right now. You know, we got into this because it's supposed to help us do planning fast. But now we're saying it's not enough to just solve the problem. You must make sure that the solution is parsable by these schemas. If you do it this way, do you think the HDN planning complexity wise would be harder or easier than normal planning? It can't be easier, right? Because in a way, you shouldn't be surprised if it's not easier, because you are putting more constraints on what is a solution. It's not enough that the solution just goes from the initial to goal state, but now it better be parsed by this schema. Okay. So in fact, it's not surprising that there are theoretical results showing that HDN planning is in fact of higher complexity. So if you get lemons, you make lemonade, right? So if you actually got into HDN planning thinking it's supposed to make your life easy, and then you, to your distress, find yourself proving a theorem saying HDN planning is harder than planning, then rather than, you know, give up and do something else, you want to say, that means it's more expressive, right? You know, if it is harder than planning, it must be doing more than normal planning. So you try to push that HDN planning now, hey, it can do other things. But remember how we got in here. Originally, we got into HDN planning thinking it's supposed to just help do extra domain knowledge. It's supposed to be suggestion. And if you are, it's making the life of the planner harder, then why is it a suggestion? Okay, but the way HDN planners are run normally, the schemas are considered prescriptive. And so in fact, HDN planning is harder in the worst case. Okay. Now, if in fact this is the only requirement for the planner in terms of soundness of the planner, it must give a solution which goes from initial to goal state, and it must be parsable. Now, if in fact you have been taught wrong grammar rules of English, right? And then you used English that's correct with respect to the wrong grammar rules, I can't slap you, I have to slap your teacher, right? I mean, I'm the last guy to be able to slap anybody in terms of English, but, you know, the point being that if the grammar that you're using, the sentence you're using is grammatically correct with respect to the grammar that has been supplied to you, like maybe you're one of those dweebs who went to an England English school, and then you stuck in US and people are laughing at you because your grammar is not correct. It's not your mistake. You're following the grammar that's been given to you. Okay? So the question of if the schemas themselves were wrong, It's a higher level validation issue. It is something that the domain writers have to check. Nobody checks it. People just give advice. It's free advice. You're not paying for it. So you take it, and you know, if you screw up, you know, that's not our mistake. But it's worth realizing technically that the correctness of the schemas and the completeness of the schemas too. That is, you know, all the good solutions, what if in fact there are good solutions that the user actually likes, but they're not possible by any schemas that you're providing? Then you are cutting down some of the solutions. Whose mistake is that? You can't say planner is incomplete. Much of what I'm saying is actually, you know, obvious now, but it was sort of, the community went through loops in figuring this out in weird ways. Because, for example, there are planners which would say, look, we wrote an HTML planner which wasn't being complete, so we then started doing extra planning on the site to make it complete. Now, why was it not complete? Because it wasn't generating the hitchhike plans for the travel domain. But if you are thinking that HTML schemas are prescriptive, then you are not supposed to generate the hitchhike plan. If you wanted hitchhike plans and your schemas didn't allow it, then it's not the planner's mistake. It's the guy who wrote the schemas who should be yelled at. Okay? So the thing that the person who makes sure this is correct is the domain writer, to whom we don't pay anything. Okay? I do want to say, and I'll go back and write later on, that for a class of schemas where, in fact, you do know all the preconditions and effects of the primitive actions in the end, and you do know exactly, so basically you start from a complete domain theory, the way you started in the normal planning. In fact, it is possible, if not for completeness, at least for soundness of the schemas can be checked automatically. Soundness of the schemas can be checked automatically. But notice that one of the other interesting things about having these plan fragments is that sometimes you can use plan fragments without knowing how the plan fragments work. How many of you cook? I mean, other than just heating pizza. Okay, right? And, you know, many of us don't quite know. I mean, you know, those of you who just started cooking, you know, somebody gave you recipes. You do this and this and this and this. First of all, you have to remember that the recipes are precedence constraints, right? If the recipes are not precedence constraints, you're stuck right in front of the range, you know, until the work is done. Okay, you say, you know, start heating the water, and then after that put potatoes in it. You know, in between heating the water and putting potatoes, you can call people. But if you call people too long, then all the water will just, you know, evaporate and things will happen. But it's a precedence constraint, first of all. Recipes are precedence constraints. The recipes are actually like task reduction schemas. Except one difference. The guy who is using the recipe, that's you. You don't quite know why the recipe works. You're using it because my mom told me, my dad told me, you know, and it seems to work. And so in such a case, if you followed the recipe and the thing doesn't at all taste, I mean, like, you know, normally, like, you go eat somewhere and then you tend to ask them, how did you make this? And they'll give you some random recipe. And then you go try it and it'll not at all look like anything that you tasted. It doesn't taste like anything that you tasted. So you have no clue why it went wrong. It was the recipe that was given to you that was wrong. So in those cases, actually, finding, you know, it becomes much, even the soundness of the schema cannot be checked by yourself. If I give you a recipe, you can't check whether it's correct or not. If I give you a recipe for South Indian cooking, you have to take my word for it. I mean, except that guy, he can actually make it. But most of you, you just have to take my word for it. And then you can do it. Okay? So originally, I mean, this is sort of a little digression. Originally, the reason hierarchical task network planning became interesting is also because you can allow planners to work in domains where you don't have complete domain knowledge. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you have plan fragments. You may know some minimal requirements as to how to patch them together. You may never be able to tell whether or not this plan fragment is actually correct. So not being able to check the soundness of a schema is actually means that you are able to work in a domain where you don't quite understand the dynamics of the domain. It's supposed to be a feature. And, you know, it is a feature because we cook without knowing how to cook. and we drive cars without knowing how, I mean, we drive cars and take care of our cars without knowing how to take care of cars. We don't know how the cars work, but we still be able to take care of them. Okay? Anyway, but for at least coming from full domain theory style planning, it is the case that soundness can be checked automatically, completeness cannot be checked. Because there may be solutions that people like, and that these schemas are killing. The only way you can yell at the planner is if, in fact, I can show you a solution that can be parsed by the given schemas and you still didn't find it. Then you screwed up. Okay? Let me end with one, this particular slide. All I said till now today, essentially says HTML planning could be seen as an albatross or could be seen as a support for planners. Okay? If it is suggestive, yeah, it is kind of a useful thing potentially, but you know, when a suggestion, the problem with suggestions are when are you supposed to use them? And it's actually, the temptation is too high for the writer of the planner to ignore the suggestion because the planner can be left untouched. Okay. Now, I'll assume in doing this that HTN schemas are prescriptive, that they must be followed. Even then, there are two ways of thinking of what HTN schemas are trying to tell you. One is to say this, which is, schemas are trying to capture what is the grammar of good solutions in the domain. What's the grammar of the good solutions in the domain? So there are like two things. A sentence provides meaning that you wanted to convey, plus the sentence is grammatical. You need both in English. Okay? Schemas are providing the grammar, and the preconditions and effect dependencies are providing the meaning, making sure that you do actually reach the goal state. If you view HTN planning that way, it sort of motivates very automatically a view of HTN planning which is bottom up, where you generate a solution, check if it's grammatical or not. In fact, most of us for whom English is second language would do it that way. We will sort of, we know what is the meaning that we want to convey. We will try to put together a sentence and see if it is sounding grammatically correct for us, and then try to remove it, rechange it, and then I'll show something to you, and it may still be grammatically incorrect. Okay? So this is a more of a bottom-up approach. The advantage of this is you can use planners without changing them. In fact, you can use any kind of a planner. You can use plan space planners, progression planners, regression planners. They can generate the solution, and then you do a quick parse of it to see whether it's grammatically correct before giving it out. But the problem, of course, is if you use it as a complete filter, then it'll never improve speed because you do everything plus extra filtering, and then you may have to backtrack. If you wind up doing it with respect to, let's say, plan space planning, one of the things you can do is you can do parsing incrementally with respect to solution generation. So as you are generating partial solutions, you keep checking whether or not there are multiple possible parses for the solution that is being produced. Okay? And when the set of potential parses for the solution that you currently have, which is a partial plan that you currently have, becomes zero, then you know that branch is dead. You backtrack. Okay? In fact, there is a way of doing HTN planning which involves this sort of a bottom-up approach that's been implemented and has been shown that in places where you think hierarchical task network planning works fast, you could do it this way and it'll still work fast. Of course, the implementation details are hairy because you are considering multiple parse trees for every partial plan. And killing the partial plan only if it has zero parses left. The advantage of this view is generating the planning techniques is simple. As long as you know how to generate parse trees for partial plans, it's done. This side, on the other hand, so there is something kind of strangely unsatisfying about this because you're doing this whole thing, this grammar, in a sort of a test way rather than a generate way. You would like the grammar to be somehow used in the generation more directly. And so if you think of hierarchical task networks as providing the hierarchical structure of the domain, then you want to sort of do top-down planning. You want to start with non-primitive tasks, reduce them, the way I was telling you earlier. There are multiple ways of reducing each non-primitive task. You consider one of them, you try to then pick the another non-primitive task, you try to reduce it until all of them are reduced and there are no interactions. There are no violated causal links, there are no open conditions left, in which case you're done. This is the most obvious way of understanding HTML planning. It turns out, unfortunately, however, that it has the maximum number of technical headaches in making such a planner work correctly. Okay? We will talk about these, some of these later. One of the most obvious things is this picture, which I'll talk next class, where you may have a partial plan which seems to have interactions that just cannot be resolved right now. A and B are non-primitive tasks, and there are interactions here that cannot be resolved at all using your promotion and demotion. The question is, can you kill this plan? It turns out that if there are non-primitive, and if you kill this plan, you can lose completeness. Because, you know, this can then be reduced to, because of the reduction schemas, reduced to a plan like this, which doesn't have any conflicts. So you think non-primitive plan is dead, but it's actually alive if you go down. Okay? And there are other issues, things like phantomization, etc. We'll talk about this as well as phantomization next class, and point out that this is part of the reason why top-down HTML planning is a bit of a headache. It's a beautiful treasure trove of beautiful terms such as phantomization, filter conditions, downward unlinearizability, all of these. Once you have a bug, you call it a feature and say, you know, this is sort of a technical headache, but nobody does it as much. And then we will also talk about this planner called SHOP, which essentially says, I will expect HTN schemas to have contiguity relations. And furthermore, I will expect somebody to tell me which is the order in which I do the reduction. So somebody basically writes a little high-level program to solve the problem for me. And that is available, that does work, but it has this disadvantage that it's not clear whether that kind of knowledge is easily available. Okay? We'll stop here and then we'll talk about that and TL plan next class.